It's Monday, October 6th. This is LA Podcast. Wow, October.
Mm-hmm. Spooky season.
Oh, well, you know, spooky season is year-round in my house.
We are recording today in the presence of the literal great pumpkin that my son has brought home.
Oh, that is a nice pumpkin.
It's huge.
Nice and orange.
Yeah. Don't put that out too early, though, because it'll... The heat makes it like melt. My name is Alyssa Walker.
I'm Rachel Reyes.
I'm Mike Bonin.
And we are coming to you from the city run by the radical left Democrats. This is a new one.
So I wish.
Yeah, exactly. Let's hear him say what he had to say to basically the top military officials in the country.
We have many cities in great shape, too, by the way. I want you to know that. But it seems that the ones that are run by the radical left Democrats, what they've done to San Francisco, Chicago, New York, Los Angeles, they're very unsafe places. And we're going to straighten them out one by one. And this is going to be a major part for some of the people in this room. That's a war, too. It's a war from within.
Okay, so we've got San Francisco, Chicago, New York, LA. Interesting that San Francisco got brought back into the fold, Mike, because you said, you know, they had a new wealthy white mayor.
And Portland as well. So
Portland, right.
So
Portland.
The administration is actually showing its commitment to diversity, equity, and inclusion by targeting cities with white mayors.
They're very unsafe places, and we're going to straighten them out one by one. I guess we didn't learn our lesson the first time around, so they're going to maybe come back through. And so we've got Trump declaring war officially on U.S. cities and also on Mike personally. So what has happened in your world over the last week?
In so many ways. So, you know, Trump is coming after sort of two of my worlds. One is Cal State Los Angeles, where the Pat Brown Institute is housed, and the other through my former affiliation with Open Society Foundation, which is a Soros-funded program that funds organizations and people who are doing work on justice. So I'll start with Cal State LA. It's actually broader. It's the whole Cal State system, but there's some special targeting for Cal State LA in particular. So last Friday in September, the chancellor of the CSU system sent a system-wide email out saying that she needed to share two pieces of information. One was that the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission had initiated a system-wide investigation of anti-Semitism, an anti-Semitism complaint against the entire CSU system. And as a result, they needed to provide information to the administration so that they could do direct outreach to Cal State employees. They also, the Department of Education, their Office of Civil Rights, has filed a racial discrimination complaint against the CSU system for its participation in a program called the PhD Project. The PhD Project is a totally separate, not publicly funded nonprofit with a mission of trying to diversify business education and the corporate workplace. So CSUs, including Cal State LA, would post job openings at the PhD Project website.
How dare they?
How dare they? So just letting people know about jobs is apparently racially discriminatory.
Okay.
It's this twisted thing where remedying discrimination actually is to this administration discrimination. So for Cal State LA in particular, the feds issued an actual subpoena against Cal State LA, demanding the personal phone numbers and email addresses of every employee of Cal State LA. Cal State faculty association is up in arms. They started filing for a TRO, temporary restraining order, but the system has complied and provided the names. And students are themselves freaking out because they figure they're next.
Right.
Right. And this comes at a time when the CSUs and CSU LA in particular are, and the students are taking so many hits. Walking to my office the other day, I picked up the campus newspaper, and in the first four pages, these were some of the headlines. System-wide budget cuts wreak havoc on class offerings at Cal State LA. Large-scale immigration raids leave permanent impact on Cal State LA. Impending government shutdown could have lasting effects at Cal State LA, impacting student work-study programs and federal funding. And then the fourth one was, how will federal slashing of minority-serving institution grants impact Cal State LA? Like, how are you a student showing up to campus
right.
and not feeling like you are being personally attacked?
Yeah.
But by hitting like the Cal State schools, right? These are working class young people.
Right.
Cal State LA is the number one ranked school in the country for upward mobility. You know, 60% of the students are Pell Grant eligible. Half of them first generation in their family to go to college. Like, they actually have done some budget cuts that are actually shutting down a daycare center on the Cal State LA campus that provides daycare for students and for faculty. I mean, just targeting childcare for working families.
That's federal funding that mm-hmm. is for, yeah, yep. for that. Yeah.
Yep.
I mean, yeah. It seems like they are asking for your personal information. Like, what is that? How does that feel?
I think it feels a little bit different for me than it does for others because I'm so used to being doxxed as an elected official, right?
It's like, you know where to find me. You know,
yeah. I mean, people have been to my house, yeah. but for most people, it's freaking terrifying, right? I mean, even if they're saying, we're just contacting you to interview you privately so you don't feel intimidated by your school about anti-Semitism on campus.
Oh, is that the reasoning?
That's yes.
why oh.
Yes.
Like,
yeah.
So you can
they want their personal info so you can speak freely about
free speech is something yeah. they are.
Exactly. But I mean, people aren't stupid, right? Yeah. If you're getting contacted by this federal government, that's meant to intimidate, right? Even if you have done nothing wrong, it is meant to intimidate and it's meant to keep you from speaking out. I've heard from faculty members at any number of colleges, including the one I'm at, but any number of them, that are really very self-conscious about what they're saying in class because they're afraid anything can turn into a quick social media meme and then you get targeted. You know, the other program that I mentioned that's getting targeted is George Soros's Open Society Foundations. Soros started this as a pro-democracy organization, and it was originally funding emerging democracies and efforts to help emerging democracies in formerly communist countries. Several years ago, they expanded to the U.S. and started funding people who were doing work on justice, on supporting democracy, on supporting nonpartisan civic participation. A lot of folks who did work on criminal justice reform. And OSF in this country has three different fellowships, a justice fellowship, an equality fellowship, and a leadership and government fellowship. Leadership and government is the one I had. It's for people who are formerly in office to work on projects. And, you know, Soros and this organization have been specifically targeted. They have been spoken of as the administration a week ago put out a memo. A senior Justice Department official sent a letter to a number of the U.S. attorneys in all the big Democrat cities, including Esalie here in California, and urged them to investigate Soros and Soros grantees for potential ties to terrorism. And they talked about things that you could potentially charge people with. You could charge them with racketeering or arson or wire fraud or material support for terrorism. So those of us who were grantees, I mean, we all expect that the administration is going to be going through every single grant with a fine-tooth comb. The federal government has several goals, right? One is actually punish some people, right? I mean, they will find people to do shit against. But it's also to intimidate everybody else. And it is to, even for the people who want to fight back, it's about immobilizing them by making them focus on this fight or go broke trying to fight it.
And in the midst of this, there's this executive order that came out countering domestic terrorism and organized political violence, which is basically what you're saying, like kind of redefining not just like the assassination attempt of myself, it mm-hmm. says, you know, right? But yep. it's also just like these very vague instances that could be claimed under, you know, if you were a Soros fellow, yep, that could absolutely. Be under this. And then and one of the specifics that is noted in here is the doxing of ICE agents, which happened in LA.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's so many things to say. Like, targeting George Soros is actual anti-Semitism, by the way. Like, that's what that is. So we'll start there. I think there's a very clear comparison to how ICE operations are going to how these two things that are happening with the CSU system, you know, are happening as well. And they're just going to start going after people willy-nilly. And some people might actually go to jail. Most people will not, but everyone will be scared. And it's exactly what ICE is doing. We saw mm-hmm. that last week in Chicago.
Every week. Oh,
The raid on a single apartment building in Chicago, where everyone, including children, were dragged out, zip tied, and lined up for mm-hmm. hours and hours and questioned about their name, where they were born, if they had any warrants out. And they didn't have any cause to be there, any reason mm-hmm. to be there, any judicial warrant to be there. That's exactly what they're trying to do here. And the whole function of these ICE raids, especially ones that are random, mm-hmm. is to scare people, because people will not want to leave their house. They will not want to be in public just in case an ICE agent is roaming and wants to stop someone. It's very similar to what you were saying, Mike, about some of your colleagues. They don't want to teach a certain way. They mm-hmm. might not want to teach certain perspectives yep. that they used to for years and years because someone might record them. It's a very similar goal of trying to create fear in order to control people. I don't know how do we move through this? I think that's where I'm at as someone who's like, I'm not involved. I'm not a professor. I'm not a mm-hmm. student. I would love to know how we support our CSU systems this system is so important, as you said, Mike, to yeah. uplifting any number of communities that are in this state, but especially here in LA. And like, it really saddens me to hear about the daycare. My high school had a daycare on campus. It allowed students to stay in school
yeah.
while they were raising their kids. Mm-hmm. And that's, I'm sure, the exact same reason why you would want a daycare on a college yeah. campus, so that people can stay in school and they can have a safe place to leave their children, professors and students alike. It just says to me that, like, not only does this administration think that we should not be in school, it's telling us that, like, we are not the people that this school is for.
Yes, that is the message.
You don't deserve any of this. Right. Like, you don't deserve to be here at all.
It is. And I mean, so many things to say about that. One is, you know, a school like Cal State LA, it is, I think, 78% Latino, right? Cal State LA does not need to do diversity, equity, or inclusion to right. get the student body that it
right.
has.
100%.
That is the student body in the neighborhood that it is in, right? If Cal State LA were going to do a lot of DEI, it would be getting more white people from the West Side, right?
that's what they're going to be ordered
right.
to
that,
do.
That's I mean, you know, and
get those numbers up.
And what is the impact if the administration keeps doing the things they're doing? You know, nobody in academia will be surprised if in the next year they start going after the Pell Grant program, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then who does that leave academia for? Right. Now, the other thing I think is really important to point out is, and you just touched on it, Rachel, is who this is really impacting. Mm-hmm. Most of the people who teach classes on any of our college campuses these days are not tenured faculty. They're non-tenure track. They're part-time faculty who don't get paid a lot. Right? They're doing it in addition to some other job. At a certain point, this threat, this intimidation, this potential cost pushes them out of academia altogether.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens to the students, right? It's the students who are impacted, because then yeah. we're denying them an education. When you go after a grantee from one of the Soros foundations, you know, it's not just the grantee you're going after. If you're taking away funding from a program that does work similar to the Innocence Project, there is some young Black kid who's going to wind up going to jail for a crime they didn't commit, right? I mean, the ripples go big and broad.
And there was two other, I think, just alarming things to note before we move on. One, this very scary story in Wired. Last week, you guys talked about, you know, all these ways that ICE is expanding their like tracking of people. And this is some documents that are showing that ICE is hiring contractors to scan social media specifically to go after either people who they think should be deported or could be used for this as well. Like going through social media now and saying, you know, these people are trying to either like maybe dox the agents or they're trying to undermine our raids. So that's just one more scary element. We should also note just another kind of update of something we talked about on a recent show, that the federal government is currently shut down. And that is the people who run the federal government's fault to be noted. But we had talked about, you know, HUD funding and all the types of cuts and that would affect our homelessness spending here in LA. And what's interesting now, if you haven't done it yet, I would highly recommend before they take it down, you can go to the HUD website and it actually says, there's a big banner on the top of it that says the radical left, once again, in Congress shut down the government. HUD will use available resources to help Americans in need. So these are the types of things. I don't know how much it's actually affecting our ability right now. We don't have a ton of federal funding. Could affect things like daycare, a lot of things we were talking about before. But this, again, is just this like, you know, incredibly terrifying message coming from like state-sponsored media and websites. Even like people were having their out-of-office replies edited by the federal government to say messages like this if you were like emailing one of these offices.
Like actual lies. You control every branch of government. Like, let's start there. The second point that we joked about earlier is that the radical left and the Democrats are two separate bodies entirely. So that's also just not true. And like, it's just like, and it's so
the middle, the moderate Democrats.
Moderates. Let's and, like, not even. That's okay. Like, we don't need to get into that. But like, it really burns me up that you go to any of these government sites now and they're calling like Democrats radical. And that like ties into everything we just talked about because it's not enough. One, I wish. But two, it's like, if you're just a run-of-the-mill Democrat, you love Gavin Newsom, you listen to his podcast, you're going to vote yes on 50, you are now considered a radical leftist and at risk of getting arrested for wearing a pussy hat 8 years ago. Like, that is the point of that, to like allow all of these little crackdowns to happen. Being a Democrat in and of itself is not arrest worthy. You know, whatever I say aside.
I love the idea. They did say they were going after like 2020 people who were involved in protests in 2020 and trying to take them out. But I love the idea of them having to go back to the Women's March to get every single person wearing a pink hat.
Yes.
Like, I mean, let's get them.
That's what I think people really need to kind of like understand a little bit in this moment. Like, it sounds extreme because it is, but that's also the logical conclusion of having all of this language being thrown about. That is what they want to do. They want everyone who like knitted a pussy hat, everyone who got money from it. They're gonna comb through Etsy transactions.
They're going to
spend our money to do that. And like, I need everyone who like rallied for Jimmy. Like, you need to rally for each other and yourselves in this moment and kind of try to figure out like, how are you going to protect your neighbors from this? Because they're asking for professors' phone numbers and emails. Tomorrow they're going to start asking us for our family and friends' information as well. So like, we need to get ahead of this and have a plan and have these conversations now. I want to sound extreme and I want to sound outlandish. I don't want any of that to happen, of course, but I would rather put that out there for folks to talk about and think about before we get to that point so that we have a plan, because they are trying to throw all of this stuff at us at once so that we can't have a plan, so that we're disoriented, and like, we need to keep stepping back and making plans and thinking bigger?
Well, one area where we will not be getting any support whatsoever from the federal government is on our climate response, including wildfire season, which is about to begin. We had this nice little rain, surprise rainfall overnight. But we also had a huge explosion at the Chevron plant last night. And it just, that watch duty app flickered on again and dropped a little notification PTSD on my screen. And I was like, ah, although I think everything was not fine because it's not okay that we have a refinery, you know, in LA County that explodes like that. But that situation seems to be resolved for the moment. Mm-hmm. Looking forward into what could be, again, another very, very bad and terrifying year. There was an after action report that was published by the county. This was specifically looking into the emergency alerts and warnings and why in particular, it covered a bunch of different things, but why in particular a huge section of Altadena did not get, a lot of my friends said they didn't get anything, like not even anything. This tries to say that like alerts went out at like evacuation and information went out like 3 or 4 in the morning. But some people I know said they literally never got anything. So let's talk about this report. I mean, I think the top, this is the headline from the LA Times, which is just like, no smoking gun, why Eaton Fire report didn't name names or assign blame. Okay. And then, so you're like, well, I got to read this. Like, what's it just like a, you know, list of like, you know, what happened, but maybe with no conclusions. What were your takeaways here? What were some main takeaways that you had when reading it?
I do kind of agree with not singling out individual leaders because it was kind of a symphony of errors. I don't know what the phrase
perfect
is.
Perfect storm. That's what they keep saying.
Yeah, perfect storm. I wouldn't use a weather-related pun for this. So I'm going to go with symphony of errors. It just seems like there were a lot of balls dropped and a lot of best practices were not being followed. Clearly, a lot of standard operating procedures were ignored. I think a lot of people might not have been trained properly. Like, I think a lot of this is a management issue. So I agree with not wanting to single out individual folks, but I also understand why people who lived in these areas want someone to point at and say, like, it was your fault, it was their fault, whatever the case is. I understand that intellectually. I obviously can never imagine what people went through, but I also, like, it just seems like unless we fire everyone, which I don't think is an option, that it made sense to me. That was kind of what stood out to me. And I thought I would feel opposite. But when I read it, I was like, oh, well, this is, there's like a lot of stuff that went wrong.
Yes. Yes. I mean, the list is numerous. And I think the most striking thing, and I'll talk about a little bit more about the warnings and evacuations, but this centralized command and communication structure has been flagged to me, or the lack of it has been flagged to me also in relationship to our upcoming mega events. This is something that is part of that letter that Connie Rice wrote that we talked about a couple shows ago, which that deal, whatever is being negotiated with the city, is still not, it's not public. They might've come to an agreement, but that was due on October 1st. And they put out a statement being like, we haven't made an agreement yet.
Oh yeah, the ABCDFG acronym thing.
So this is basically like us making an agreement with LA28 about who's responsible for which costs when it comes to emergency and fires and evacuations, like a lot of really important things that could happen while there are millions more people here. But that's one thing that has been flagged to me elsewhere. Mike, your reaction to all of this?
Yeah, there were a number of things that stood out to me. One, it was striking to me that so many of the findings of this report were the same findings of the 2019 after action report for the Woolsey Fire. Very, very striking that so many of the recommendations were the same, and those apparently had not been acted upon or implemented. The other thing that struck me is and both Supervisor Horvath and Supervisor Barger were critical of this, is the number of agencies that refused to participate in the after action report.
That list is quite long.
The Los Angeles Fire Department, the State Fire Management.
City of LA.
Yeah. I mean,
are they allowed to opt out of?
They could argue, I guess, that they're doing their own.
Yep. But that's the problem, right? I mean, you're never going to get the full picture if people are not cooperating with each other, right? If you're only looking at what one jurisdiction does at a time, when it's a multi-jurisdictional thing, that's a problem. That was, I am sure that there was some state lawyer and some city lawyer who said, oh, you know, you don't want to be doing this, but it really it made the report itself glaring in its omissions. The other things that were missing from the report, and Supervisor Horvath pointed this out, was there was very little mention, I think just one mention of the people who died, right? Mm. And there was, I believe, no mention of the false alerts that mm-hmm. went out and how that contributed to the confusion. But my main takeaway was this thing where nobody was to blame. And I think Rachel, you're right. I mean, this was a perfect storm, and there really was no person who could be held accountable for it. Although you can argue that if you had in place a county chief executive, there would be somebody who would be held accountable, right?
Rick.
But
coming soon, Rick Caruso's responsibility.
The fact that there isn't anybody who can be held accountable, and ordinarily, even if there were no individual in a system who would be held accountable, like the chief executive is generally held accountable, right? Mm-hmm. Mayor Bass is going to be held accountable for whatever they find out about Los Angeles. The county doesn't currently have that. And the fact that this was a dynamic where the problem was systemic and confused and hard to point to exactly where things went wrong, and there's no accountability, so there's no one person responsible for fixing it. Well, that kind of sounds like the county generally, right? Mm. I mean, that's how LA government, the county
so
in
convenient.
Particular, but that's how city and county government were intentionally designed 100 years ago, is to have authority diffused like that. And this is
Spider-Man
one of
meme,
the, yeah,
just basically as
yeah.
government.
And this is one of the consequences of that, right? And it's you could say the same things about this fire response as you could about homelessness response, mm-hmm. right? That there's the systemic errors. There's, you know, this agency does this, this agency does that. Nobody's really in charge. Nobody's accountable. And that's sort of the dynamic of our structure.
Yeah, it is pretty shocking to, and we should note, and we talked about this before, I think when Mike and I talked about like the 6 month after the fire episode we did, our city report is waiting for some kind of federal approval before it is released. We don't really know why. They're trying to investigate the cause, I guess, and that will be as part of it. So they're waiting to release it again, like as we go into fire season, like as we haven't seen like evacuation plans updated.
Well, the feds
like,
won't
like
release
that.
It until we say that the fires were started
right.
by undocumented
That's
immigrants.
Right.
Or Antifa.
And Antifa.
And undocumented Antifa immigrants who didn't sweep their forest floors, even though we don't have forests. I mean, this is, so your point is so good though, but it's like Mayor Bass will be, you know, blamed for everything no matter what. And probably maybe even some staff will maybe be fired for mm-hmm. things that happened. And
Chief Crowley already has.
Right, exactly. There's going to be collateral damage here. But your point is so right. Like everybody at the county's kind of floated above this and been like, oh, well, perfect storm, you know, what can we do? The false alarm was surfaced by CanX reporter A.B. Silverman, who has this great TikTok that we'll put in the show notes, but basically asking like why everybody was terrified by this. It was like a whole news cycle with like Janice Hahn like getting very mm-hmm. angry like yep. when this happened, and this wasn't included at all. So it's like, what is the purview of this? Like, how do we make sure this doesn't happen again? In many ways, that was kind of the most terrifying day, and then we still mm-hmm. we had this like false alarm that went out to everybody, which they think probably happened because maybe some of the towers were themselves destroyed. destroyed by fires. It was like an echo is what they were calling it. It was actually from the Kenneth fire, but then the emergency alerts themselves aren't written in a way that you can look at it and be like, oh, this isn't for me. Yeah. You know, they weren't doing a good job with the language. So we hope that's changing. And, you know, again, having something like Watch Duty that we all kind of did on our own, there's no help from anybody that told us to use this app, this nonprofit, this like completely disconnected from our government service that ended up saving lives. But I just, as far as like pointing to the one thing, which I think is maybe the most important thing. Yes, it was two perfect storms, basically, because it was the Palisades fire happened. All of our resources were shifted all the way over there. You know, the county was, you know, there. And then this fire, you know, pops up and it's going to be impossible for them to fight a fire on two fronts, basically. You know, it's I totally understand that. But it does seem that there was this total breakdown on deciding who was going to get evacuated and when. And there's this 4-point part of the report that I just read over and over again. And I mapped some of these locations and I kept looking very closely of just like, you know, where these reports were coming in, where these 911 calls were originating. And there, it seems to almost say that like, because they weren't quite sure of where these reports of fire were actually happening west of Lake, right? So it was an address that the house never actually burned. I can see there being a lot of confusion about information being given incorrectly. You know, I don't think we should say that, like, you know, if somebody's reporting a fire, like, great, evacuate the area. Like, I think that's pretty easy. And this part in particular, during the interview process, County Fire Department staff recall suggesting to Unified Command staff a little before midnight on January 8th, so this is the fire started on 7th, that due to high winds, evacuation orders should go out for the foothills all the way to La Cañada. Unified Command staff did not recall this occurring and reported that the front was not moving west into those areas at that time. We know now that that's not the case. Yep. Like that is what was happening. So obviously there's like people who hold those jobs. Like I'm pretty sure you could find out who those people were. And that to me seems like the breakdown. And the way that like I was also trying to understand this was looking back at Edgar McGregor, this amazing like young climate scientist who has this Facebook page and who I've been following long before, you know, the fires, just gives great reports on like, you know, how climate is changing the foothills. And he does these trash pickups that have kind of gone viral. And he made a video, you can watch it, at 7:17 p.m. that makes this warning saying anybody all the way to Allen should go now. And anyone above Altadena Drive should be ready to go immediately and pack your car. And if you feel like you need to go, you should go. Then he posted another message at 10:22 p.m. and said, even on the west side, people should consider leaving and that you should not wait. You should not go to sleep. And we don't... That to me shows that at least one person who had the knowledge and could see the fire actually coming and had, you know, the scientific, you know, the scientific like data like backing him up for what should happen. He saved probably, I said dozens, but now I think it's more like hundreds of people's lives. Because a lot of people said they saw cars streaming past their own home and realized that they needed to leave. And the other bit of information that came out, which is really interesting, there was a story that just came out this week. Hours before the Eaton fire, the distribution lines failed and fires were started because they had not de-energized some of the lines in different parts of Altadena. So people could have been reporting like, hey, there is a small fire by me because the, you know, the lines are still active and maybe your house didn't burn down from that, but that makes it maybe a lot more possible to understand, you know, why some of these other 911 calls were coming in. I mean, this is just, nothing gets resolved by pointing fingers, I guess. But again, we go back to this, like we're acting upon these recommendations, which is a big statement that was put out. It was a very contentious meeting. I mean, I just want to play this like highlight reel that Lindsay made of her just like demanding answers. This is how contentious it was.
So I heard two different things. So is it both? How is it both? And where in this report and any appendices are we linking to the congressional report that was done? That is a very frustrating answer to hear. And so it should have been included in this report, whether it's part of the appendix or some other place. So I hear you, but that is not the experience of my constituents. And for them to hear that they were not educated or properly trained is not true. They know quite well. That was a point of information that actually my office had to push to be included in this report. How did you decide what to put in this report, and why are things like that not included? First of all, is all of that true? And second of all, if it is, when did we find out about those challenges?
And yeah, the question is really like, we go back to, I don't know, the county doesn't really have an emergency management department. Like, they have one of the lowest budgets for emergency management.
That is similar in the city of Los Angeles.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? The emergency management department, the city of Los Angeles, is tiny, is barely funded, has been the case for years. I remember one of the reasons I voted against one of the budgets in my last few years was because it was cutting that department, which, representing the Palisades, I thought was freaking nuts. But in both cases, the city and the county, those units are underfunded. In the county, it's even worse because they're not even their own department. They're just reporting to the county chief executive. One, there's no really robust, effective coordinating agency in an emergency, right? The fire department has to do what they're doing. Transportation has to do what they're doing. Getting the alerts out, like there's nobody who's thinking of the whole thing. One of the things that stood out to me in this is that there's no real TikTok of what happened here.
Timeline.
Yes,
yeah.
There's no real
there are many TikToks.
There's no real, yeah, right. But the best TikTok is TikTok, yeah. Right? Because that's where things were documented.
It's true.
There's nobody who's documenting what orders are going out when, right? Everything is being sort of reconstructed after the fog.
Yeah.
There's no human documenting equivalent of a black box for this emergency, right. which is a problem. There's also this huge problem with technology. I mean, some of the details about the antiquated technology were pretty jarring. It sounded to me as if they were not geo-plotting the 911 calls that were coming in, which is really a foundational step in figuring out where to do evacuation.
Which makes me wonder if there's mistakes with reporting that too.
Exactly.
Because it didn't line up. Like, some of the addresses didn't line up.
Yep. The other thing I think is worth pointing out, because I don't want us to be guilty of the same sin that the report committed, but Supervisor Mitchell pointed out in the conversation that the report was essentially silent on the racial disparities of outcomes in Altadena. Mm-hmm. She described it as the elephant in the room that was not mentioned.
Can't expect a bunch of people from Alexandria, Virginia to know these things, yeah. Mike.
But as Holly pointed out, Black residents of Altadena were far more likely to have their homes damaged or destroyed by the fire. It's not necessarily that somebody was sort of racially biased in saying we're not going to be sending out alerts to Black neighborhoods, but what, if any, are the contributing factors of sort of inequity or resource allocation that may have led to that? That's something that needs to be addressed. And I know there's going to be other after-action reports on issues evacuating people with disabilities and other things, but that's something that really needs to be looked at, unless that means we won't get any federal funds for anything because we're looking at racially disparity.
Probably, outcomes. Yes. I mean, we should assume. I mean, even just basic things, and this goes back to, again, like the messaging. I is write about disaster messaging in the context of these types of things. I'm like obsessed with it. I'm obsessed with how we tell people to leave and how we tell people to get ready and how, you know, who is getting that information to you and how. And a striking conversation I had with someone who, and there's a lot of like climate scientists that live up in this area, right? And I think they probably have saved a lot of people's lives too, mm-hmm. because they were tapping on maybe their neighbor's doors and be like, hey, just wanted you to know, like, you know, this is actually really bad. I was looking at, you know, National Weather Service closely. But even this thing that keeps coming to mind, you're supposed to have your car packed and backed into your driveway, facing mm-hmm. the other way, ready yeah. to go. And one of my friends was telling me that, like, they had never heard of that before. They mm-hmm. didn't know they lived in a fire zone. Mm. They didn't know that they were at a high risk. Yeah. They just had an apartment and he moved into a place and said, this is a yeah. cool place to live. Like, there's just little basic things like that that get drilled into your head or should be, or maybe in the Palisades because they thought they lived in a high risk
yeah,
area.
It was in Palisades. People
right.
knew that.
That was, everybody knows that. But you just didn't have that same type of information. And where are those messages now? Like for the next community over, like for right. La Cañada or something like that. Like, I don't, yep. it's these little tiny things. Like, those things can make a huge difference in who gets out, how word gets out, you know, how fast you're able to escape. that was like a key message that I felt like Edgar McGregor was out there, you know, spreading on his Facebook page.
Well, and I wonder, I doubt that in the use of a phrase, but in the heat of the moment of these emergencies, is there anybody from the Emergency Operations Center who's actually monitoring this stuff? Because this is stuff that they may not know intuitively, right? Because they're not the scientist in the room. The public may be getting better information in some cases by being on social media. They also may be getting some bad information, but then the folks in the emergency command center and having a robust enough emergency management department where somebody is like in tune with that and is sharing that with the incident commanders would be important.
It should absolutely be someone's job. When you were talking about Edgar, I was thinking like, gee, that would be a great job for someone to have who's monitoring TikTok and Twitter, Instagram, Blue Sky, and being able to identify like, oh, like this person lives in this place or this cross section, like something is happening here. I'm going to like tag it somewhere. And Mike, to your point, we also should have someone who is a human black box that's like able to coordinate and start creating a timeline. That's like part of emergency preparedness is that like you would think someone would have started a timeline immediately and not after the fact when everything kind of is all over the place. But Alyssa, I will say that we learned that in school, like emergency preparedness for earthquakes and fires, like all of that was taught to us. I back in everywhere. I don't park my car head first, literally anywhere. It's easier to escape in an emergency if you're already facing the right way. So it makes me think we need some type of guide when people move here. Like if you are just moving here from Ohio or whatever. This is a fire area. This is what an earthquake is. This is how you prepare. And I mean, like obviously that's a joke, but I do agree with you. Like what are the steps that we can take in this moment to adjust this? Because Mike, it sounds like we haven't made any improvements since 2019, clearly. And I wonder if we were to try and place blame, what are the Venn diagrams of people who were employed during the Woolsey fire and employed this January? And maybe we talk to those people. Like, why didn't we have improvements? Obviously, you can't stop fires. If a fire is going to happen, like, I understand why people want to know the cause of the fire. I think that could be very informative and also very helpful. But I still think that, like, a lot of our energy can be focused on organizing around the terrible response that we had and the disjointed response that people saw. 19 people should not have died because of this. We should have totally overhauled how we responded to fires. Who was in charge, I guess, of, you know?
County CEO? Yeah, I think that's
I
a
guess
great.
Kind of, but like, yeah. Without that, who was in charge of improving?
And one thing, just to sort of get to the psychology of how government functions and dysfunctions, you've got a very big, diffuse bureaucracy, right? Mm-hmm. So when there's nobody who has the desire and the authority to do something and is focused on it, it makes it very hard to do something. So the various pieces that needed to be moved, there was nobody in charge of all of those pieces. And, you know, 6 years ago, people were still enough in denial to have thought of maybe the Woolsey fire as a 100-year incident, right? You can't freaking live in that in that denial now, right? I mean, this is going to happen again next year somewhere, right? Mm-hmm. It's going to happen, you know, in the next few months somewhere. But one of the dynamics that happened here, I'm sure, is that this report came out in 2019, and then 2020 happened,
right?
And any institutional momentum for anything got focused on the pandemic and the response and everything that the county had to do, you know, and now everything is getting constantly rejiggered based on whatever executive order the administration may point out. It really is going to take someone really on the board. And it sounds like both supervisors Horvath and Barger are interested in playing this role of really just insisting that this be something we get a report on every 60 days. What has changed in the past 2 months?
Just like, what 100%. Are we doing? What are we doing? Like starting next month? Like it's, it's happening. Like there's no, with and going with into this with no city like you know, reflectiveness, you know, right? Like I'm like, we do not have, again, I keep going back to this sounds like really silly, but like Daniel Swain, the amazing like forecaster communicator that like had been like an Edgar McGregor type of a person who, you know, we felt like was speaking directly to us and giving us these like live streams of what was happening on the nights of those fires. And then after, we need somebody like that who can be at the, maybe the county, maybe the city, I don't know, like, you know, on the top levels of government who is speaking to us directly, you know, and we can't have it filtered through these elected officials or the emergency officials who are too busy or too, frankly, not versed in the climate science enough to like explain what's going on, you know? So we, that's what we, that's what I want.
Who should be deemed the Lucy Jones of,
exactly,
of fire.
That's what, well, even Lucy Jones is really good at this.
Yeah. Like,
you know, Lucy Jones can be the Lucy Jones of fire. She's the, she was a city seismologist for a long time. And, you know, this was, it was her job basically was to communicate the risks and tell us how to get our fucking act together. So yeah, it could be some, it could be her, it could be someone like her, but that is what we need. And without that, you know, the same thing is going to happen again. People are going to die, you know, and hopefully it's not during the Olympics when there's like millions more people here. Right. Rachel's face. Rachel's ready.
I also think that like,
for that alone, we really do need to be doing this on video.
Rachel's Olympics face. She's like,
oh God. I also want to say thank you, Mike, for bringing up the racial disparity aspect of this, because we're going to see it, well, for a lot of other reasons, but specifically in this situation when it comes to rebuilding and who can rebuild and who can't rebuild and what Altadena should look like after these fires and who is Altadena for. And like, I think those are questions that also need to be addressed in a report. And as you said, I'm sure one will come out, but I also don't want to lose sight of that because I do think it's very important. But also renters, people who might have been renting in the Palisades or renting in Altadena, like I also don't want to lose sight of them. Renters have a lot less protections, of course, than homeowners do. And then, yeah, unfortunately, this like is it a DEI conversation, but it's still factual, and we still should be talking about these things, regardless of what the regime says. It's our reality. This is the population of the city that we live in. So, I would love to see those lenses also brought into these conversations continuously going forward.
Well, I have the report for you. It's called Confronting Disaster, Curbing Corporate Speculation and Post-Fire Altadena. It's by SAGE, Inclusive Action for the City, Marina Strategies, you know, all these other groups that have been, they actually did another one that we had talked about earlier in the year that is basically, you know, focusing on exactly what you said. How do we get renters? How do we back? How do we make sure that, you know, these racial disparities aren't exacerbated? How do we keep these corporations from coming in and buying up land? And I wrote about it for a story on the failed rebuilding commission authority that that we, you know, the Spencer Pratt of it all for the Los Angeles Review of Architecture. And we can link that up in the show notes. But I wanted to talk really quickly about rebuilding just as our final segment here. Great segue. Thanks, Rachel. Because we had something that was kind of notable. I think the rebuilding director of Malibu resigned. Only 70 structures or something there had been out, you know, it wasn't, the impact obviously wasn't to the level of the Palisades, but there were hundreds of structures destroyed and only a few dozen permits are going through. Said the mayor should resign as well. And then we had this really great package by Liam Dillon, friend of the show, LA Times reporter who's now headed to Politico.
Congrats
Liam. Yes. But this big package looking over the past few years, both with Woolsey, Camp Fire, other major fires in California, like how we just have not rebuilt it at the pace, or maybe in some places we shouldn't be rebuilding there. So this is not the only way to track our success, but other cities have been able to at least put people back in their homes, in their neighborhoods, in safer situations. And we have really failed at that here in the LA County region. I think something that that was in Liam's story that was really interesting was that, you know, we have lost more homes over the last 8 years than any other time in California history. In some years, we were like losing more homes to fire than we were able to like build homes, because we're so bad at just building homes straight up. And that of all the burn zones they were looking at, only 38% of the structures had been rebuilt. And that, and the makeups of the cities and how they were changing, they were getting younger, they were getting richer. They were, I don't think younger is necessarily bad, bad thing, but like definitely like richer, whiter, you know, there's a change that is happening in a lot of these communities. And like when you were looking at like what is the problem here and what are, you know, what are the things that are holding it back, it's a lot of it is similar to just like what's holding us back from being able to build homes in general. You know, it's a mm-hmm. lot, it's a lot of the same issues. And one topic that keeps coming up is that we are not able to retain construction workers,
yep.
Not just for single family homes, but also for multifamily homes, for even for, you know, large scale developments. What is happening here, Mike?
So a bunch of members of the city council this week, Karen Price and Hugo Soto Martinez, joined by four of their colleagues, introduced a proposal to study raising the minimum wage to $32.35 per hour for certain residential construction projects. And I think it's important to point out which sort of projects these are, because these are construction projects in the city with 10 or more residential units, right? So this is not impacting a fourplex. This is not impacting
a
single family
home.
And under 85 feet in height, right? So this is not also impacting mega projects, right? This is, sort of medium-sized projects, many of which are not union jobs, right? And many of which have, you know, layers and layers of contractors and subcontractors, many of whom do not get paid particularly well. And given the climate we're in now, where, I mean, this is a heavily immigrant workforce, that's significantly impacted by all the shit that's going on. And it's also hard for people, as Pete Rodriguez from the Carpenters Union pointed out, it's really hard for people to be able to afford to live here. And if people can't afford to live here, they can't work here to build here, right? Mm-hmm. So you actually need to have a population that's paid well enough to build. So this would raise that wage for these kind of units. It's interesting because it has the support of abundant housing, which is sort of, you know, if there were going to be a group that would say, oh, no, we don't want to do this because it will impact housing construction, that would be one of the ones you would think would be jumping forward. So the fact that abundant housing is on board is, I think, actually pretty significant. It shows that this is not just about paying workers better, as it is and should be, but it's also about how can we get housing to be built faster. I will say, for those who are getting very excited about it, because it's got, you know, seven signatures on it, six or
so
seven signatures.
Should already be almost a go, right? To
get something through the LA City Council, you need 8 votes. So if you've got, you know, 6 or 7 to start with, you can have a lot of confidence. But I've been the sponsor of stuff where we had 6 or 7 signatures. I think our initial $15 minimum wage was like that, but it was like given birth to get it there, and it took a year and multiple studies.
You don't have
studies.
Any idea what that feels like.
And this is true. I don't. this is very, very true.
Giving birth is probably easier.
giving birth is a lot faster than actually getting a $15 wage and passed. There were a lot more people who got hired to do the pushing on the minimum wage. A lot of doulas. But it's also important to note that this motion says, let's study this, right? So there's a lot of people who signed on that, you know, it may be hard to get them to sign on at the end, but it's a really important thing to do. And it does point out, it's tragic that we need to be doing wages like this, that we need to be doing them piecemeal and in chunk, right? That we need to do the hospitality workers. Now we need to do this. These huge chunks of the economy that are just as desperate and just as needed of this and are left out.
If we can make sure that we're giving cops rent money so that they can live in LA and injure people, perhaps, then I think we can do it for construction workers. Like, that's something we actually need. We need to be able to pay construction workers a wage that they can live and thrive in. And I like recognize that they also need to be able to turn around and live here so that their mm-hmm. commute is not 2+ hours both ways, which also contributes to climate change. Like, we need to ensure that the people who are here to build are being paid well and also can afford to live here too. So there's absolutely a world in which we can give them stipends or give them free housing. Whatever we do for cops, we should be willing to do for everyone else, especially because most other people help the city operate and function in a way way that we can all benefit from.
To our friends in Sacramento who are mulling over what their proposed legislation will be in the coming year, a modest proposal. Set the California minimum wage statewide so that nobody can be paid less money than an ICE agent.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, with the signing bonus incorporated. And we should note, like you mentioned, Mike, kind of the particular parameters of the type of housing that could be built through this. It seems like this is intended to piggyback on SB 79, which is could mm-hmm. be passed by the time that you are hearing this.
All eyes on Gavin.
And so it's just kind of an interesting way to maybe some deals were struck and mm-hmm. some conversations were had. And then one other thing I just wanted to point out was that, you know, we've had this ongoing narrative about how people aren't building in LA. They aren't building housing. They're being scared off by things like ULA, rent control type of thing. You know, there's all these different reasons, I guess, why developers are saying that they are not building new apartments here. But there's a new story by Roger Vincent in the LA Times that talks about how it's actually the investors mm-hmm. who are being scared away from these projects. And I have one very unfortunate quote by someone who says that LA has been redlined by the majority of the investment community. Unfortunate phrase.
We really live in the era of people saying the quiet part out loud. Yeah.
Let's rethink that. But a developer without investors would be like a king without clothes. I am an optimistic developer who wants to develop, but the investment community won't participate. It's just like a different way of framing the problem, I think. Like, yes, maybe we've made it too onerous to build, and even like attempts to do that at the city level have been rolled back. Even, you know, they were very popular, and then they kind of like, yeah, we didn't mean that in single family neighborhoods, just kidding. but this other idea that like investors see LA as too unpredictable mm-hmm. or not surging ahead in the same way that other small cities are in the region. Mm-hmm. And that's just something to think about. Like, raising the minimum wage will be great, but unless we project that feeling forward with our policy and our actions.
And more challenging to do when the city is constantly under siege by the federal government and you've got masked troops roaming the streets, right?
Yeah, well, I guess it's all on purpose.
Well, also, it's the same city that can't build the People Mover on time.
Oh.
And then also wants to turn around and build the convention center in
future episode teaser.
What, do you think that, what if the convention center gets finished before the People Mover? That would be.
I think that people should move into the convention center and live there.
Oh, well, that solves a lot of our problems then.
That's
what I think. We will go into that on a future episode, Rachel's plan for Occupy Convention Center.
And we'll whip it all into
shape. And the graffiti ghost tower. We're going to take it all over.
Yeah.
Those eminent ghost domain towers look so cool.
They look cool. We were talking about this before the show.
I went to Comic-Con last week with my son, and walking out of there, one of the coolest things about that section of downtown is I regarded as graffiti art. I mean, I mm-hmm. thought it was really cool.
It is. It's art. It's beautiful.
We did a whole episode about it. It like is literally art.
We love you, graffiti ghost towers. and we love you, Los Angeles. If you would like to help support independent media and get invited to a future party with your co-hosts, subscribers only, go to thinkforward.la and sign up for a subscription. Tell your friends, tell your coworkers.
And this week on Wednesday, on the next episode of What's Next Los Angeles, I will be talking with Mike Young of California EnviroVoters about all the things that happened for and against the environment in the last legislative session in Sacramento.
We will look forward to that. Thank you so much to Sophie Bridges, back as our producer this week, and we will see you next week.
Later.
Bye.
I wonder what is going on here. Is this space hell or is it paradise? And will we make it worse or make it nice? What's the forecast tonight?